always Kane Sims, and I am making the assumption that this is live. Last week, it took me 3 minutes or so to work out whether it was live, and in that process, people are just kind of watching me stumbling around in the dark, trying to push buttons and see whether things are live. So I'm trusting the process right now, boys and girls. Welcome to VUX World for the second podcast since my return, since having a wee little baby, and the baby's doing fine. I'm lacking sleep, obviously, and so Mark, if I do today via off course or start chatting absolute rubbish, more rubbish than normal, I think it's expected that I will chat some degree of rubbish, but more than normal, then please do give me a prod. I'm probably lacking severe sleep right now. But before we get into today's conversation with Mark Worden, and it's going to be an epic conversation indeed, because Mark presented at VUX at the EU Chatbot Summit in March in Edinburgh, and the topic area is absolutely fantastic. It is all around how NatWest and Mark's team approach designing an accessible chat interface. It's WCAG compliant. It's, I think, the only chat interface that I've seen that is accessible. And really, the importance of this can't really be overstated. And no one's really given any airtime or even talking about accessibility, even though conversational AI, in theory, should be the most accessible interface on the planet, because all you need to do to access it is talk, basically. But there are some fundamental limitations of many of these chat interfaces that do exclude people with certain accessibility needs, whether that could be blind, whether that's physical impairments. It could even be temporary situations where you have accessibility needs. Like, for example, you might break your arm. How do you then navigate and use your devices with a broken arm and stuff like that? And so Mark and his team have put a whole load of effort into building a completely accessible chat interface, and we're going to get into that whole story and how it went down in just a moment. But before we do that, I need to tell you about two things. One is the Unparsed conference. It's an in-person conversation design conference, the world's first. It's full of world's firsts today. World's first in-person conversation design conference happening in July the 24th and 25th in London. It's organized, co-organized by VUX World and LabWorks. We are bringing the world's leading conversation design experts to London to share essentially the best practice in this moving and changing world as it is. And so please do check that out. If you're interested in attending, you can save 50% on your tickets. Just go to unparsedconf and you can use the promo code VUXWorld to save 50%. And we'll see you in London. There's another event happening next week in London, Tuesday and Wednesday, Reworks Conversational AI Summit. I'll be there. I'm going to be hosting, facilitating a panel or two, and I would love to see you there as well. You can go to rework.co/events to find out more about that, 16th and 17th of May. So it's a busy few weeks coming up, and I'd like to introduce our guest for today, Mark Worden of NatWest. Mark is the strategy and innovation lead at NatWest. A lot of experience in conversational AI, a lot of experience building and working on Cora, which we'll get into as well, and has led the team in producing and building this accessible chat interface. So Mark, without further ado, welcome to VUX World, my friend.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Thank you for spending some time with us. You're going to a different event next week, Generative AI Summit.
Yes, yeah, going down to London for a couple of days. Chris from my team is actually speaking around some of the research he's been doing into how we could effectively try and implement some form of generative AI in quite a heavily regulated industry. So, yeah.
Nice. We'll get into some of that, hopefully. Maybe it's at the back end of this conversation. I'm not asking you to give away Chris's talk, by the way, but I'm sure you've got some perspectives on that. So it'll be nice to get into that.
Yeah.
So thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. And maybe I'll pass you across next week. Who knows? We will both be in the big smoke, and so, you know, maybe a whiskey or two can be shared if the moment is right. but aside from that, tell us about yourself, Mark. Tell us a little bit about yourself, about your role. And also, I'm always interested in learning how people kind of get interested in AI in the first place.
Yeah, sure. So I've been at NatWest for 10 years in February. And I started in branch, actually. I was cashier. So that's kind of how I got into conversational AI. That's a weird thing to say. But I worked in branch for 4 years, and then I was lucky enough to move out of branch into, we have like an internal colleague FAQ system at the time. So our colleagues could say, how do I order a card for a customer, and depending on where they worked in the bank, whether that was branch, telephony, web chat, it would give them the answer. And that's actually how I started looking at conversational AI, because that soon evolved into our own internal chatbot. So I worked on that chatbot for a couple of years, and then I moved across to the Cora team about 3.5 years ago. So yeah, I've been working on conversational AI in NatWest for about 6 years now. And more recently, I'm, as you mentioned, the strategy and innovation lead for Cora. So my role and my team is to look at kind of emerging technologies and new use cases for Cora and the strategy we have for Cora, and to separate the hype from the reality and what works, pass over to our delivery team to then inevitably put into Cora.
Nice. So you were on Cora from the beginning then?
Not from the beginning, no. So around the time we started Ella, which was the chatbot I was working on, is around the time they started working on Cora. So I think in February it was Cora's 6th birthday. So yeah, it's I've been on the journey for about 3.5 of those years.
Nice. And where was Cora when you kind of first got involved? Like, what was the state of it at that point? Or what was it doing? And what was it kind of, was it working well? Like, what can you describe to us, generally speaking, the lay of the land from Cora's perspective when you joined?
Yeah, it was very much help and support, very much simple kind of help journeys, doing what we could to try and remove some of the pressure on human colleagues. We were just starting to look at automation in terms of what journeys could we do, what could we do from a transactional perspective for our customers. And I don't think at that point we had any kind of tone of voice guidelines or anything like that. We were responding very much to the data from what customers were searching in Cora and trying to build those journeys very quickly. I joined in 2019, the back end of 2019. So quite shortly after that, COVID happened. Which was then kind of an all hands on deck. I think the wider team managed to get our mortgage holiday and payment holiday journeys live within about 48 hours of the announcements from the government. So it was a bit of a mad time looking back at it, actually, because it was all hands on deck, people working long hours to try and get stuff out there, because it was the most effective route for customers to join a queuing system to then come and talk to us about those payment holiday breaks they needed from going on furlough and being let go. So it was an interesting time. And that's kind of the first few months of joining the team.
Interesting. So the payment holiday use case, was that, in terms of its traction, did that just naturally get, it sounds as though it was well used, like did that just naturally get adopted? Was it, were people pushed towards it? Like how did that find its feet, sort of thing? I think I've lost you there, Mark. Don't know if...
There we go.
People
were pushed towards it just because it was the most effective way of a queuing system at the time. You know, at some points the queues were up to like 36 hours for an agent to respond. So it's not feasible to have someone on the phone waiting for that period of time, whereas to give them the reassurance they're in the right place, we will get back to them. We had a huge surge in volumes as soon as the government announced those kind of schemes. So yeah, it was definitely, people were pushed towards that method. But I think it was nearly 500,000 conversations that were handled and those payment holidays were dealt with. So it was, wow, it was quite effective in getting customers to the right place pretty quick.
Wow, that's very impressive. I've just noticed, is that Hogwarts behind you there?
That is Hogwarts behind me, yeah, absolutely. Oh,
that's the dream, isn't it? That's the massive Lego, is it?
Yeah, there's loads of different modular sets that have come together.
That is what I'm all about. I'm very much into Lego these days, as with a 4-year-old child, and I'm glad that he's into Lego, because it's ideal. That is on the list, that one, definitely. I just caught it there. So that was a big accomplishment. 500,000 users, that's fantastic. What are some of the other kind of, from then till now, obviously we're going to get onto the accessibility stuff in a moment, but what are some of the other sort of like milestones between then and now that you think were sort of like, you know, noteworthy for Cora in terms of your experience there?
Yeah, so I think like one of them for sure is just the level of automation that we've started putting into Cora from our authenticated team. So we like Cora can change your address, which is, it was probably one of our biggest what we call process handoff journeys, in that it had to have a human key the request. And we've actually seen data recently where if a customer changes their address with a human, they're like 20% likely to call our telephone department to ask if it was done correctly the next day. If they change the address with Cora, they're only 2% likely to do the same thing. So it's also nice to see those kind of that kind of validation that actually by having Cora do that, then it's also helping the kind of peace of mind with the customer as well. So I'd say that's definitely one of them. We've got quite a few journeys in the pipeline now where and in production where Cora can just complete the task for the customer. And we've also implemented Cora into our IVR system as well. So we have a small team that works on it, but we've got a few journeys, transactional, some of them are more help and support, but those journeys are being received really well. So when the customers are handed to Cora, they're getting the right outcomes for sure on that channel too.
Nice. Sounds good. That's perfect. That's what you want, isn't it? So where did the whole accessibility question come from then? So we'll get into the solutions of that, but like going back, you know, over the last sort of like 18 months or so, maybe longer, where did this need arise from? What made you think, I think we need to be taking accessibility more seriously?
So we had... as a bank, so each channel, so our e-banking platform, mobile platform, web platform, Cora as well, we've all had like annual accessibility audits. And in a part of my role previous, when I first year I joined the Cora team, I was the one who was liaising with our third parties on those accessibility defects and with our internal teams where it was stuff that we could change, potentially copy was incorrect, things like that. So that was when I started to get a first awareness of kind of how many defects that we have across our estate, because we don't just cover Cora, we cover the help and support FAQs. So that was kind of the first moment where I really started to understand what accessibility was from a Cora perspective, and what we could start to do to really kind of help our customers. We also then... began a monthly accessibility forum where each of those channels come together, because ultimately we're all making the same mistakes. So our mobile team would be making a very similar mistake that we've made in the past, or we might make a mistake that our e-banking team have made. So we started that forum to kind of collaborate and share our learnings and what we'd understood from the findings of those audits and how we were then looking to fix them. And that was kind of the beginning, really. We have an incredible One Bank accessibility lead now in Bex who led that forum and is probably one of the most passionate people I've ever met talking about accessibility. And yeah, it kind of started from there. And we have an Enable network internally who did a roundtable with four customers with various access needs. So they spent an hour with those customers and talking about their channel preferences. So it wasn't specific to chatbots, wasn't specific to e-banking or the mobile app, but it was just more banking in general. How do they access it and how do they prefer to interact? And some people with some defects were saying that they absolutely preferred not to speak to a human face-to-face. That's how they prefer to do their banking, which is very much where we can help with that scenario. And others, it was more a physical disability where actually it was quite difficult for them to get into a branch and they preferred to do their banking more digitally. So that was quite an eye-opener. I think there was one of the women on the call said something along the lines of, you know, I've tried to do this before and it didn't work, but it's probably my fault. And I remember sitting there watching it thinking, it's absolutely not your fault. That's how that's been designed. That's our fault for the way that we've designed that. And I don't know, that kind of really hit home with me. And then we had the opportunity arise where we were looking at, do we actually build our own chat user interface? And that was absolutely one of one of the selling points for me was, hang on, we could, if we have full control over this, we could design this in a way where anyone can use this and not have an issue.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, the it's quite a common theme, that the whole sort of like users blaming themselves. I remember I did a lot of work with government in the past, and one of the things that we used to always do as a mandatory sort of activity was, any new project that we took on, we would do usability testing on the existing service. And then when we did a redesign, we would then do usability testing on the redesigned service. And so we could compare and contrast. And one of the things that was always the case was that when people make mistakes, they would, well, I'd say mistake, when people couldn't accomplish a task, they always blamed themselves all the time. And the fact of the matter was, like, the websites are so poorly designed. The information architecture is all over the place. There's so much jargon put around all over. Sometimes the information that people need isn't actually available on the website at all anyway. And people are like, oh, it's probably just me because I can't find it. You know, like, people have a knack for blaming themselves all the time, don't they? Which is,
yeah,
it's mad. Yeah. Is it, was this a, because it was, as I said, with government in the past, excuse me, it was kind of like a government mandate, essentially, which said, all government websites from, I think, might have been the date, might have been 2018, like July 2018 or something like that, by that point, had to be WCAG 2.0 compliant. And then there was just like a massive initiative, like all government bodies, central, local, everyone was working on making their websites accessible. Was that a similar sort of situation with you, or was this just coming from elsewhere in NatWest and someone said, you know, the right thing to do is to make things accessible? Or was it driven by kind of a legislation initiative or something like that?
It was more driven kind of from Bex Brindley, in terms of she now is the One Bank accessibility lead throughout the bank. And with the accessibility forum that we have on all the kind of digital channels and the digital estate, with this forum, we're kind of making that commitment that everything we design is designed with accessibility in mind. Mm-hmm. And whilst we're doing that design, because there's a number of those platforms that are going through migrations to new designs, we also want to make sure that we're also actively going back and fixing what is in our capacity to fix, so that we can try and become an accessible bank by design. That's the kind of tagline of what we're going for. And I think it's been really that drive, and, you know, Bex has taken presentations up to the top of the bank and got sign off that this is absolutely the direction we want to go in as well. So there's just been a real focus on it over the last 12, 18 months. And I think that push has really sort of helped, because we're almost that community of different banking channels, and we're trying to learn from each other and reuse what we do in one channel in another place. It's just almost just created that community kind of drive within, and that culture within NatWest, which has been great to see.
Nice. And you mentioned there, you know, to create something yourself ultimately gives you more control, and you can do kind of what you want with it. What are then some of the limitations that people will find from an accessibility perspective with some of their current chatbots, for example? You might go to Dialogflow today, you can create a chatbot, you can deploy it on a website, there's a chat interface there, you know, you can use any other platform, name one, they all come with a front end that you deploy on your website. And I think the general consensus amongst people who aren't aware is that it does the job. It's live, it allows people to talk to it, you know, it kind of does what it needs to do. Maybe some limitations around how you can make it look and feel and design wise and stuff like that, but I think there's just a gap in terms of, certainly from an accessibility perspective, in terms of where some of those limitations might be. So I wonder whether you could share what some of those gaps are. Like, what were you finding from your current provider that just wasn't kind of where it needed to be?
Yeah, there was a few things from the audit that we had where we saw some common themes. One of them was tables. So displaying information in a table, our provider didn't have that as a piece of what we would call structured content that we could use. So it was almost created a little bit hacky in behind the scenes. So it was actually a collection of buttons is the way our tables were built. But because of that, from an accessibility perspective, when a screen reader was then trying to read it, it was just announcing button left, right, and center. It didn't tell the user it was a table. The things that were clickable weren't announced as clickable. It was a whole nightmare, to be honest, in terms of tables. And that kind of brings me on to just UI components in general. Carousels are a bit of a nightmare if they're not set up correctly from an accessibility perspective. Some of the issues we saw was that the buttons were embedded within the cards, so they were hard to see. On mobile devices, there were no buttons, so you could only swipe, and that is an accessibility defect because some people struggle with the swipe gestures. And it was there's a lot of focus around it's called the focus area. So anything that's interactive should have a box around it. If you tab on any website, you'll start to see the box moving around, and that's to highlight any interactive elements to people with a screen reader. Quite often on chatbots, they'll either be too many of those in places where they shouldn't be, or they're not in the places they should be, which can then confuse someone with a visual impairment. And aside from those kind of things with the UI, obvious color contrast as well is probably the main one. If you are customizing your own look and feel to those kind of chatbots and you're putting your own colors on there, absolutely run it through a color contrast checker, because that's something that a lot of people will put to one side and forget. And actually, it's a super simple thing to fix from an accessibility standpoint, just making sure your colors contrast in the right way. But from a conversation design as well, from that perspective, you know, if you have too many chat bubbles in one turn of a conversation, or too many options in one turn of a conversation, so you might be like, oh, click this link, here's a video, here's this, and before you know it, you're just causing cognitive overload for all customers, let alone people from the neurodiverse community as well. So there's a lot of different things that we learned. There were some things that were in our control, which is more the latter, the conversation design, and we've gone ahead and implemented those principles, but there's certainly a lot from a UI perspective that you just won't even consider in terms of how they work. We always find as well that if when we build something for NatWest Chat, or when we've tested stuff for our previous provider, you need to make sure you test on a variety of devices, because what works absolutely fine for Chrome, for Edge, for Windows, for Androids, might not work fine for Safari, and vice versa. Something might work absolutely fine on Safari or using iOS's in-app accessibility settings, but doesn't for Android for whatever reason. So it's about just having that wide variety of devices, because customers will as well. So We want to make sure that whatever we're designing works kind of across that kind of landscape of devices that can be used.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned color contrast. I remember the first blog of mine in probably 2012 or so. I wouldn't encourage you to go there now, because what happened is my domain expired, kanezims.com expired. Now someone's got all of it, turned it into this, Chinese advertising landing page. And further down, there is some extremely, not safe for work stuff in there. So I'm on this quest to try and get my domain name back. But anyway, the very first version of that blog, I thought it was really cool to use orange text. Orange text, white background, looks really super cool. And it was going for about a year, 12 months or so, until someone messaged me on Twitter one day and said, by the way, I just thought I'd tell you that your website is an absolute nightmare for me. And I was like, why is that? He said, well, I'm colorblind and I can barely read the text. So I think they had like red colorblindness. And because I was using orange text, it basically just the whole page just looked like really faint words. And that was the first time I'd ever kind of been exposed to someone with an accessibility requirement using something that I'd created, and I just felt terrible, because I was like, this has been like this for like 12 months. And I think when I was working in some accessibility stuff again in government, the research was out there was saying that something to the tune of between 9 and 12% of the population have some kind of color blindness.
Yeah.
So it's like just color contrast on its own can potentially be exclusive for like up to 10 to 12% of your people, which is, you wouldn't even think of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's even simple stuff as well. So those boxes I mentioned, the focus area, if depending on the color of your website, will then dictate what color you'll need to use for that, because if that doesn't pass color contrast with all the different areas of your website, then it's great that you've got the focus area. That's fantastic for people with the screen reader, but for people with that visual impairment and the screen reader, they can't see where it is. So yeah, it's an easy one to miss, but also an easy one to fix.
Yeah. And how did you go about finding, as you mentioned there, you know, using multiple sort of like, you know, conversational bubbles, for want of a better phrase, you know, multiple kind of responses and having videos and all these kind of things in a single response? I mean, it's obvious for a designer to look at something and say, that's too much, you know, especially if at any point the text goes above the fold, so it's hidden, you've got to scroll back up to see it, you're definitely in dicey territory. So there's an argument there, which is that it's good practice anyway to keep things concise. But when you mentioned there that certain people with certain accessibility needs, there is that sort of like cognitive overload. How did you go about identifying that? Because it seems as though the audit that you did or can do, there's tools out there that can scrape a website and just assess whether it's WCAG compliant based on things like those focus areas and color contrast and that sort of stuff. But to get that kind of like qualitative feedback from the end user that says, actually, that's too much. Did you do anything in terms of that qualitative exploration with people with accessibility needs to try and determine those kind of limitations?
Yeah, so we have an internal team that does accessibility team for us. So we always get them to run through our accessibility testing if we're developing any kind of new component or if we're using a component in a way we haven't used before. We'll always make sure that before it's released, we'll get that team to test. And in the past, we have had, there have been people in that team who have got access needs. And I actually find that, as weird as it's going to sound, the most interesting people to test our products, because I think the first time we designed for focus areas, for example, we threw them everywhere. We were like, well, we want to announce everything. Every time you tab, we want everything to be announced to the screen reader. And the gentleman who came back and he ran through all of our tickets with our UI dev team in India and with myself and some of the people on the project from the UK. And it was just sitting down with him and understanding why that was an issue for him in particular, and how much easier it is for him to use the product by reducing it to just the interactive elements, and almost understanding the reasoning and not just, here's a huge document of WCAG guidelines, go through them, read them, and just see if it works. It was just useful to get his understanding and his experience, really. And I think for one of the experiences that stands with me is when I was working on the internal facing chatbot on the Ella team, we were doing a pilot to expand to a new business area. And there was a gentleman who had a visual impairment. And it was the first time we'd come up against like making sure that things were accessible from that perspective. And I spent an hour shadowing him, and he had the customer in one ear on the phone. He worked on the phones. And he had his screen reader in the other ear. And the speed at which that screen reader read was just astonishing. Like, I don't know how on earth he kept up with what the customer was saying at the same time as this screen reader was saying in the other ear, and also talking to the customer. But it was like a magician, honest to God. I think it's just by having someone who has the issue with the product in the first place explain why it's an issue is the easiest way to start to then understand what you should be doing going forwards, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. I mean, I've had this conversation a number of times on the podcast. I think the last time was with Micah Coppens with the concept of kind of user-centric design. And people, I think, the conversation I had with Micah was, have we forgotten everything that we've learned, basically, which is that in software design, in user experience design, in any form of product design, really, if you're designing in a user-centric way, you're at least, if you're not involving users directly in the creation and design, you're at the very least putting it in front of those people during the process so that you're getting actual feedback and you're responding to the real needs of real users. And it's just amazing how, fair enough, on the one hand, you could say that conversational AI is more of a technical kind of you know, to create a really robust conversational AI, it requires a whole load of technical skills. There's no doubt about that. But I think what ends up happening is that the companies and businesses lean into the technical aspects of it because they view it as a technical project. And even though we bring designers into the situation and into the mix, for many coming into conversation design, they might be coming into conversation design from writing. There might be a playwright or a content designer or something like that, you know, which is great because you need multiple perspectives and multiple skills. But it just seems to me, at least in my experience over the last kind of half decade, that there's a little bit of an absence of some of the typical UX design practices that should be part of every single project that's created. Any product that touches a customer should involve those customers at the very least from a testing capacity. So I think what you're describing there is exactly what, you know, you should do, and especially when it comes to accessibility, because there's no way at all of being able to figure out whether or not you're doing the right thing unless you can put it in front of people with those needs, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And for me as well, is we have people in the team who have various access needs, and they range from people in neurodiverse community to people with physical access needs. And I think just by having that inclusive kind of workforce too, like that's one of the things I enjoy the most about working here, is that we do have a diverse team of people that bring themselves to work, and you can almost call on them just to keep you in the right place as well. As you mentioned when we were speaking at the conference, it came up, you know, there's four white men on the panel talking about accessibility, and I do think it's important in making sure that you do have that diversity across the team, and at the very least in the people who you're testing with.
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. What was I going to say there? I've lost my train of thought now. I'm sure it was incredibly invigorating and exciting. But you're right though, you know, you have to actually get it in front of the right people, because that's the only way you're ever going to find out whether it works. Oh yeah, that was what I was going to ask. You mentioned it a couple of times now, neurodiversity. In that, because I've never come across that term before, within that kind of category, are we talking things like dyslexia, dyspraxia, those kind of things?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Just wanted to clarify. Okay, so that sounds good. So I think we've been through the process of the requirement to be more accessible emerged through conducting various audits, various assessments, putting together a working group, realizing through an audit that the tools that you are using currently don't particularly work greatly effectively, and then the decision was made to kind of redesign the interface. It's and then we've kind of gone through the process of doing that and the learnings in terms of things like color contrast and your learnings with carousels and screen readers and stuff like that, including the target user group as part of that process. Was there anything that we haven't covered during that process to get to where it is today that you think is important for anybody who's wanting to do something similar and make their conversational AI more accessible?
Yeah, so one of the things that we have included in NatWest Chat, which is the name for the interface for Cora that we've put out there for one of our brands at the moment, is the ability to change Cora's text speed. And that was actually quite a big defect. It was a blocker that we had with our existing supplier, in that if Cora was to deliver more than one chat bubble, like to the customer, what it would do with the screen reader is it'd start reading the first one, and then when it got partway through and the next one was delivered, it would stop and then start reading the second one. And yeah, there's a workaround. Customers can tap back up and they can rehear the bubbles at their own pace, but it's not a great experience in the first instance, in that we're just interrupting halfway through a sentence basically and then reading the second sentence. So we've given the ability for customers to change Cora's speed, and what that means is they can slow it right down if they're on a screen reader. And the reason we did that is because NatWest has an initiative called Banking My Way. So anyone can go onto Banking My Way, they can register any kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Any changes that they may need based on the scenario. It can be anything from a family member's just passed away, so they might need support with that, or it could be something which one of the most common ones we looked at the time was, you need to speak slower to me. And that was definitely more aimed at our branch and telephony staff, so they can see that there's this marker on the person's account when they register, and they can go, right, I need to speak slowly to this customer. But we really took that to heart with Cora, because actually it's the same thing. Cora's having the conversation. So we added in that ability. Right now it's very manual. You'll have to go in and you have to change it, but we do have plans further down the line to actually take that data from Banking My Way and go, this customer's already told us this, so we're going to automatically slow Cora down. And then if they do speed it up, then we'll remember the latest setting that they've set it to. But that's kind of one step that we've done, which is an enhancement on what we originally had. I always make the joke, we can't do that with agents. Can't control how fast their agents speak. But for Cora, we can. So we absolutely should and do with NatWest Chat. We are looking at further enhancements down the line along those veins, almost an accessibility features panel where we could increase the text speed, decrease the text speed, those kind of things too. But we felt it was really important to get that in for the first delivery. And yeah, it's our conversation analysts are very happy with it anyway, because when they're testing through the conversations, they can speed Cora up, and it's always the opposite effect.
That's it. I mean, I have noticed myself over the last kind of like probably, I don't know, a couple of years, listening to more podcasts. And even now, so I'll speed up the podcasts really to usually like 1.5 times the speed. Or if it's like a long podcast that I want to get through, I'll put it on like 2 times the speed. Same with audiobooks, I'll at least have them on like 1.5. But what I've also noticed now is that with some YouTube videos, I'll do the same. And I'll actually go through the pain of going into the YouTube settings and speeding it up, which I don't know, it's mad. Like, because it's not, this is kind of eventually getting around to, again, some of the conversations that we had in Edinburgh, which is that when you design for accessibility and you do things like allow for the playback speeds to be increased or decreased, when you do things like you make clickable elements bigger so that you can tap them quite easily on a thumb on mobile, when you do things like make the language plain English and you strip away all your jargon, and when you do things like make sure that the colors have significant contrast, you're not just designing for accessibility, you're designing actually for everybody, because it makes things better for everyone, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was playing God of War Ragnarok just before Christmas, and I remember going on Reddit and seeing the sheer amount of accessibility features that they included in that game. There was a large community of people who didn't have access needs but were taking advantage of the things that those accessibility features did. I know I turned on a few of them myself, and it just made the game easy to play. And yeah, it's exactly that point. If you're designing for people, even with, as we kind of talked in Edinburgh, temporary or situational access needs, so maybe they've just had a baby like yourself, they've got a child in one arm, so they only have one arm free, or they've broken their arm, or they've lost their arm, so you cover that spectrum. By designing for the people with the temporary access needs, you are completely designing for everyone across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you a good... Are you an Apple person or Android person?
Android. I recently made the switch.
Are you? Interesting. Well, Android, I'm assuming they'll have the same features. But one of the things that I've come across recently, which I think is fantastic, is I've added it into my shortcuts now. So if I... At night time, when it gets to probably about, I don't know, 8 o'clock or so, it's not automated yet. It should really be automated. I don't think I can set that up. But basically, I'll just click. I've got this little accessibility shortcut down here. I don't know if people can see. I click that, and then the color filters come on. Click on color filters, and everything turns black and white. And so I get rid of all the colors. And what that does is, basically, rather than everything being, when I open my phone, everything's like mad colors and there's red dots on all of the sort of apps and stuff like that, it just basically just nullifies your phone. So you don't really feel like, it's surprising how much colors can do. Like when you just look at your phone's home screen, the colors get drawn in, all of a sudden you find yourself in an app. You know what I mean? So I put it on black and white every night so I don't get distracted. But that's an accessibility feature. That's not necessarily for that purpose, but having that feature available makes it better for everybody, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's amazing what just changing the colors can do.
Yeah. It's mad. That is fantastic, generally. And as I said before, when we were speaking at in Edinburgh, was that, you know, the lengths that you've gone to do this, I think, is great. And I hope that this conversation and those that are tuning into it kind of take notice of the importance of that. Like, there's a really good thing. I forget the lady's name now. There's a really good content designer. I'll find out the name and I'll put her link in the show notes. She used to work for GDS. And round about the time when I was doing a lot of this work around accessibility for government services and stuff like that, the central government were publishing a lot of guidance around things like content design. And one of the things that that they used to say is that dumbing it down is opening it up. Because a lot of people that you speak to, I'm sure you've probably had similar situations at NatWest where you'll speak to certainly people that work in certain departments and certain teams, and they're just wrapped up in the knowledge, you know, and they need to be wrapped up in that knowledge because that's their job. But that knowledge and that language surfaces on the front end of your website and your app if you're not careful. And those people think that if you're just going to take out all the terminology, shorten all the sentences down, then you're just going to dumb the content down. But the whole concept is that when you do that, and if you do dumb it down, you then open it up to be accessed and understood by everybody rather than the people that understand big words, you know?
And I think, like, working in a bank, I think we absolutely do get wrapped up in that sometimes. You know, we'll have conversations and if there's one thing NatWest loves, it's an acronym, right? So internally, like, we'll just have acronyms for everything. And I feel bad for, like, even new starters, right? So not even talking about customers here, just people joining the team, because we'll often say, like, all these acronyms in one sentence, and then, like, I'll almost then have to stop and think, hang on, does that person know all those acronyms? They've only just joined. But I think we are quite guilty of it as a bank, and I think, you know, that can sometimes bleed itself into journeys that we create, right? Because we're so wrapped up in this kind of financial world that we can often assume other people have the similar level of knowledge to us. And I think I read this fact, or I get told this fact quite a number of times, and I don't know what exactly the right number is. It's somewhere always between 9 and 12, but the average reading age for the UK, I'll hear it's 9 or it's 12 or it's 10. Mm. It's not high. And actually, financial terminology isn't the easiest thing to ingest. So I think there is a lot of things that, especially to that point of if you dumb it down, it makes it easier for everyone. Absolutely. Especially when it comes to finances. And we're in this weirdly unique position where a customer could potentially be with us their entire life, right? So they can join with us with a child account, and it naturally just grows up with them until they're planning for life after work. And to be with a customer on that kind of journey, talking about all the different complexities throughout each life stage in a simple way to help coach them through it, I think that's quite a skill that it's definitely something that we're looking at more in terms of how can we become more accessible for that sort of financial guidance. I'm not going to use the word guidance, but
yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the case though, isn't it? Because like the financial literacy in general, you know, from a populist perspective is lacking. Mm-hmm. And a lot of banks are adopting that position now, which is, yes, obviously the typical banking stuff you'll always be able to do. Your money will be safe with us kind of thing. But at the same time, it's helping people do things like save for retirement, helping people do things like save to buy a house or whatever, making sure that people get the right kind of mortgage based on their situation or whatever it might be. So a lot of banks are kind of moving more into that sort of like, you know, the guidance advisory sort of position to help people, you know, with their whatever their situation is. And you can't really do that unless you speak the same language as them.
Yeah.
And unless you have your things and your services available where they need them, when they need them kind of thing. So it's I suppose, everything we've been talking about from not just an accessibility perspective, but I suppose how it fits into the wider NatWest kind of strategy is, I imagine, opening up your resources, your information and your services to as wide a demographic as you possibly can, so that you have more chance of being, you know, being there from childhood to retirement or what have you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important with that sort of tone of voice and the language that we use, because the last thing we want to do is frustrate a customer, create that friction point, and for them to then choose a different channel to ask that question, which may not be as convenient to them as just simply loading up Quora and asking a question. So yeah, it's vitally important that we get that right, and that we make sure that the direction we're going in, we, as you say, I'll say it again, just design with those accessibility needs in mind, because it'll help to design for all, like from a content perspective, from a copy perspective, from a UI perspective. It just helps across the board.
Mm, absolutely. Wicked. So I can't let you go without asking a few questions about what you might expect to be spoke about on an AI-focused podcast, which is the the generative AI movement. I don't know if you saw Google I.O. I haven't actually saw it myself yet, because I've been extremely busy today and last night. But I did see a very a really good clip with Google CEO, and it was someone on LinkedIn shared something like, startup capital or startup funds are really difficult to raise these days, so take a lesson from Google CEO and use this kind of stuff in your pitch. And the whole video was just his keynote chopped out. Every single time he mentioned AI was just like thrown back together, so the whole video is just Sundar going AI, we're working on AI, deep learning, AI, and it's just the whole thing is so funny. So obviously there's been a lot of things announced, but I haven't seen it yet. I don't know if you've saw it. I don't know what your thoughts are generally on one is Google, OpenAI, those big players providing these foundation sort of models, and then also how that might apply to some of the stuff they are doing with Quora.
Yeah, I've not seen it myself personally, but it's really interesting in terms of the scope of what we could start to achieve. The difficulty is the obvious things that everyone talks about, in terms of the reliability, the ethics, the hallucinations, and the last thing we want to do is in any way implement anything that would start to give our customers wrong information, especially when it's to do with people's finances. That's one of the most important things to people, if not the most important thing to people. So we are starting to have a look at how we could do that in a safe way. And we are starting to look at the use cases that we would have, that we would want for Quora. We're fortunate in that we have a few internal conversational assistants. So there are things we can do in that kind of test bed and work with those partners to understand how they're using these kind of new technologies and implementing them and how safe they are. One of the things we're starting to look at the moment is how do we actually use our own content on the websites. So if a customer has a conversation with Quora, we don't have an intent for that conversation and it's going to go to our fallback, then can we actually use generative AI to look at our web pages, our own web pages, and then summarize that part of the web page and deliver it to the customer? So there are things that we're starting to look at, and there's potentially more exciting things on the horizon. In terms of, yeah, so that's from a kind of generative AI perspective. In terms of from like an accessibility perspective, we are looking at our natural conversation framework. We're very keen to start looking at voice. And as part of that, we're starting to play around with how do we make sure our journeys are designed voice first, because they absolutely aren't right now. Our journeys have been evolving over the last 6 years from the first inception of Quora, and definitely voice wasn't the thing that was at the front of our minds back then. But equally, start to have a think around, can we actually, if we are starting to look at our websites in terms of helping with those small scale answers that we don't have the capacity to build, does it also then make sense to start thinking about potentially changing the level of understanding that a customer would require to read it? So, you know, if a customer does have a lower financial capacity or capability, then do we actually display our answers in a different way? If we know they have a specific vulnerability, do we display answers in a specific way as well? So there are things like that we're starting to think about. And actually the conversation framework helps with that, because when you talk about voice, customers might want well, first of all, they might not hear, so they might just ask for Cora to repeat. Right now, Cora doesn't have that capability, but with this framework, she would. And equally, if a customer didn't understand something, they could ask Cora to explain, which would then give that almost, as we were speaking before, sort of dumbed down version of what she's just said. So it would help with that. So yeah, there's a few different things we're looking at from kind of a generative AI and accessibility perspective, for sure.
Nice. What's the natural conversation framework?
So this is our fancy name for looking at how can we set in a framework in place where we design journeys voice first. So voice is a huge direction forwards for us from an accessibility perspective. And by actually making our conversations more conversational, so less reliant on a logic tree with buttons, which is what we're quite reliant on now, then the theory is that we could actually apply a voice to digital Cora and have that extra feature from an accessibility perspective. And it also means that we wouldn't potentially be designing one variation of a journey for our digital Cora, so web, e-banking, mobile, and a separate one for Cora on IVR, because in theory it should be interchangeable. They should work.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, I think you'll definitely find the challenges of voice being different. Like you mentioned there, the like button-based chip suggestion stuff, you know, with chat you can fall back on videos and carousels and images and tables and stuff, whereas in voice, reading a table back through a voice interface is pretty much impossible. And so it's definitely different. You've got a lot more, the immediacy is more prevalent with voice, so you've definitely got to respond in real time, whereas chat, people can pause, reread the sentence, scroll up, see what came before it, whereas voice is ephemeral, and once it's gone, sort of thing. So there's definitely more, like, it's not really conversation repair. People will call it conversation repair, but it's not really. It's just the nature of voice, which is that, yes, you'll get more people asking for clarification and asking follow-up questions like, you know, why do you need that information, or what are you going to do with that? And, you know, things that you might not expect in chat because you've got guardrails and you're giving suggestions and almost like pushing people into a certain space. With voice, it's the general architecture needs to be a lot more robust because it can go anywhere, you know. And then you've got the speech to text to worry about in the first place, you know. Is that accurate? Are you feeding rubbish into the NLU in the first instance? And so how can you sort of like, you know, get that more robust and stuff like that? So it's definitely an interesting challenge. But for me, that's like, voice is conversation design, you know. A lot of what some would consider conversation design, I wouldn't necessarily think so. It's more, I'll say, business process design, really. If it's start here, three options lead to these three things. at this first thing, it can go down here, and that more kind of like keyword based stuff. It's more like a business process that you're building.
Yeah.
You're not really. Whereas with voice, you've got the effect, essentially the equivalent of a mini business process at every single turn of the conversation, and then more so because the clarifications and further questions and so on. So it gets. Yeah, it can be quite complex, but I think that the approach of designing voice first is the right one, because if you can nail the conversation itself without guardrails and without buttons and suggestion chips and without all that kind of stuff, if you can get a conversation pattern working in voice, then you're right, that'll apply anywhere. And it'll be robust, as you like, in every other channel, because you've got a lot more guardrails in those other channels. And so, yeah, if you get voice working well, then you're, that's what I call pure conversation design. Basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice. Cool. That's wicked. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining me. It's been fantastic. As I said before, I genuinely think that this work in accessibility is, one, it's groundbreaking, actually. You know, it feels kind of like wrong to say that accessible design is groundbreaking, because it shouldn't be needed to be seen that way, because it should just be, as you said, accessible by design. But as we've said and as we've discussed, you know, not all companies work in that way, which is a shame. But I think that the work that you're doing and where you have Cora now and where you've got NatWest Chat now, I think is a perfect example for everyone else to follow. And I think that the fact that this innovation is coming from an enterprise rather than the vendors, I think is, one, I suppose it's symptomatic of the fact that you're closer to the customer anyway. But two, I think it should be a lesson to all those vendors listening, which is that going forward, large enterprises, I think, are going to start asking questions about accessibility. And so everyone, I think, needs to start building their stuff with accessibility in mind, definitely. And I think it's thanks to you and conversations like this that things like that can happen. So thank you for joining me.
No worries. Been a pleasure.
Thank you all for tuning in as well. What's going on next week? I would give you what's happening next week. I don't exactly know who we've got on the podcast next week, which is really bad of me. Let me just see if I can go and try and find that out. Oh, actually, it's Core AI, actually. Yes, we're going to have Gopi from Core AI, and we're going to be talking about AI in retail. So any retailers out there that are interested in how conversational AI, generative AI, large language models are reshaping the future of retail, then definitely tune in. This one's going to be interesting because it's not just about conversational AI on the front end. It's also how do you integrate that with back-end systems and processes and employee experiences to make the entire end-to-end retail journey more streamlined. So please do join me for that. And if I don't see you then, I hopefully might see you next week at Rework's Conversational AI Summit. And so all the best. Thank you so much. And we'll see you.